So in particular, the class of non-commutative geometries that I work with are so-called fuzzy spaces. So my plan for now is to try and tell you what non-commutative geometries are, tell you what fuzzy spaces are, then explain how we put fuzzy spaces on the computer. And afterwards, I'll tell you a little bit about what we look at when we look at non-commutative random fuzzy spaces on the computer. Please interrupt me with questions. I know you are all tired. I'll admit I'm actually tired. So I'm afraid this talk will not be as light and interesting as Eric yesterday, but I will do my very best. And nope, sorry, no movies. Somewhere hidden on my computer, I have something where I try to turn non-commutative geometries into sound, but it's probably better for everybody's ears if we don't look at, don't listen to that now. I should do it again at some point. So non-commutative geometries, I'm talking about non-commutative geometries in the sense of Alan Korn. I always like to start with that caveat because there's also Kappa-Minkowski and other ways to think about making coordinates non-commutative. But I'm really thinking of the spectral triple. Spectral triple, the part that is a triple, is what I've marked in red on my slide. That's the Hilbert space, the algebra, and the Dirac operator. In addition to that, we've got the KO dimension. Oh, wait, no, I have the signature, not the KO dimension on there. The chirality and the real structure. So the idea is that instead of having a describing a geometry as the manifold with the metric and the maps, we can describe the manifold, the geometry, as a Hilbert space with an algebra of coordinates acting on it and a Dirac operator. And the metric information will be contained in the Dirac operator. There are mathematically rigorous theorems that you can reconstruct everything from that. And I was planning to put a quotation on here, but I forgot. But you can just Google Alan Korn and you will find a lot about that. So a simple example for a geometry where you can do this spectral, describing it spectrally, is if you just take a Minkowski space and then the Hilbert space are the L squared spinners on that manifold. Functions on the manifold are just all square integrable functions. That's the algebra. You've got the Dirac operator, that's just the normal differential operator. The signature is given with q minus p mod 2. So that comes, q and p are the number of Hermitian and anti-Hermitian matrices in your gamma matrices in your spinner chain, spinner space. You've got a chirality matrix, that's gamma 5, and you've got charge conjugation. So all of this structure is already there, and this structure actually defines the manifold for you. And now the thing is that in this structure, right now, that's a commutative manifold because your algebra are just all functions, and the functions commute with each other. Now, you can replace that with a non-commutative algebra and find something more general. And so there are infinite non-commutative spaces, but infinite spaces on the computer is infinite pain, so we're not that interested in those. And that is why I have not actually learned that much about them. The type of spaces that I've learned about are fuzzy spaces. In fuzzy spaces, we make the Hilbert space and the algebra and the Dirac operator, we all make them all finite. They become finite matrix geometries. And that makes our life very easy. The canonical example for one of these is the fuzzy sphere. In the fuzzy sphere, you've got a Hilbert space, which is a Clifford module tensored with a matrix, the vector space of n by n matrices. The Clifford module for the fuzzy sphere, this is, by the way, the Grosse-Prisnider Dirac operator on the fuzzy sphere. There are different variants of the fuzzy sphere, but this is sort of the best known one. Now, the Clifford module is a 0-3 Clifford module, and it's spanned by the Pauli matrices. We all know and love the Pauli matrices, right? The algebra, in this case, is properly non-commutative. It's the algebra SU2. So, of course, the algebra is SU2, but to have it acting on our Hilbert space of n by n matrices, we need to use an n-dimensional representation of SU2. And then the Dirac operator acting on the Hilbert space can be written like this. So this is the identity operator, and then we've got products of Pauli matrices with generators of SU2. These are the Lie algebra generators of an n by n wrap. And this is one example of a fuzzy space. If you want to get a physical intuition of it, what you've done here corresponds to, you've taken the complete sphere, you've written the sphere in terms of the functions of the sphere, you've written them in terms of the Hermite polynomials, and now you've just cut them off at some large m or n. So you've, this is a way to cut off the modes on some level. And that is kind of the idea that I like about non-commutative geometry, that you're taking a geometry and you're putting in a spectral cutoff. You're cutting off the modes that you allow to propagate on your manifold. So we get discreteness, but we get discreteness in the sense of we've put in a spectral cutoff, we haven't put a space cutoff. Oh. Oh. Okay. Good. She'll probably stop and we'll just ignore if she doesn't. Okay, so. It's kind of late in Germany. What's she doing online? Okay. Okay.
Is this cutoff related to n or is it not?
It's vaguely related to n. I mean, if you make n larger, you get a larger cutoff, but n is not directly corresponding to the modes that you have. So it's, well, I sat down to try and figure it out at some point, and I got somewhere, but.
Maybe you can just switch off your Wi-Fi.
Translate it, that would be fun for us.
Well, the problem is half the audience is German, so they already know what you said. Okay, so these are the fuzzy sphere. And now, the fuzzy sphere is one of the well-understood fuzzy spaces. There's some ideas about the fuzzy torus and fuzzy CP somethings, but we don't have that many exact fuzzy spaces that we understand very well. Of course, spheres are super easy because very, very symmetric. Everything is very simple in that way. But to do quantum geometries for that, we'd want something more general. And fortunately, no. That was further ahead than I want. Yeah. So this is the slide that I want. Fortunately, we can write something more general. We can define a general fuzzy space. If we want to do the general fuzzy space, we're just saying that the Hilbert space is some Clifford module V tensored with a matrix algebra. We've got the algebra itself is now the matrix algebra, just general matrices. We allow anything. And then we've got the signature, the chirality, and the real structure doing their thing. Okay, please just put that somewhere. So now the tricky part in the general fuzzy space is what is the Dirac operator in the general fuzzy space? And yeah, Chris?
So in the previous slide you had the SU2 algebra.
Mm-hmm.
Product was the Lie bracket, I suppose, then.
Oh, you mean this?
So, well, you take as algebra as you do.
Ah.
So, what kind of product do you have? What kind of algebra product?
I actually don't know on the top of my head. I have not looked it up. I mean, normally because it's a representation, it's matrices. So, I know that in the general case, the product on the algebra is just the matrix product. So. Well, you have to use a representation of SU2 when you're acting on the Hilbert space, which are the matrices, right?
Okay.
So you've taken a representation of it, and then you can use the matrix product. So now the tricky part is the Dirac operator, because the Dirac operator has to fulfill a bunch of conditions. And these conditions are, we want it to be Hermitian, which is easy. it needs to commute or anti-commute with the chirality and with the real structure. Whether it commutes or anti-commutes depends on the signature of your space. So like we know that, okay, now I've got a 50-50 chance if it's odd or even dimensional spaces that don't have a chirality. I can't remember right now, but so we know chirality has that, and for the real structure something similar happens, that it can be plus or minus. Whether it's plus or minus depends on what's your Clifford module. And then there's this condition, and that's the so-called first order condition. What the first order condition says, if you put it in words, is that the Dirac operator has one part that commutes with the right action of the algebra and one part that commutes with the left action of the algebra. So our algebra has a right action on the Hilbert space, and it's got a left action on the Hilbert space, which is defined with the real structure. And now the Dirac operator has a right acting part and a left acting part, but these two parts commute with each other. So it's got a right action, it's got a left action, but it doesn't have a part that does left and right action at the same time. So those bits are independent of each other. What that means is that we can write the Dirac operator as a kind of sum. We can write a sum. Here, this is a product of the matrices in the Clifford module. And then so these are all linearly independent products of matrices of the Clifford module. And then we've got a left acting matrix and a right acting matrix. So we can split everything into these two parts. Epsilon prime is plus or minus 1, again, depending on the signature. Now, using that we can split the Dirac operator into left action and right action, we can write it. So K needs to fulfill Hermitian or anti-Hermitian conditions depending on if omega is Hermitian or anti-Hermitian. Because if it wouldn't, then, so if omega is anti-Hermitian and K is Hermitian, then the whole thing would be anti-Hermitian, which means our Dirac operator would be anti-Hermitian, which is what we don't want. We want it to be Hermitian. So either both are anti-Hermitian or both are Hermitian. And we can use that to write the Dirac operator as commutators or anti-commutators with matrices. So H are Hermitian matrices and L are anti-Hermitian matrices, and these are some of the geometries that we've explored. We've explored quite a set of them, but these are some of the simplest ones, gamma matrices. Now, the most complicated one that we have looked at in detail is the 1-3 geometry. And then you see the Dirac operator starts to get interesting, because now you've got so many gamma matrices that you can form. So there's three of these, one, two, and three of these again. So we've now got 8 matrices in the Dirac operator that make up the Dirac operator. We've got 6 L matrices, 6 anti-Hermitian ones, and 2 Hermitian matrices H. And these matrices, in some sense, are our free data. We can now pick these matrices however we want. Well, however we want, as long as H is Hermitian and L is anti-Hermitian. And any H's and L's should give us a fuzzy space of this type. And that is basically at the basis of what we're going to do. We're going to change H and L to integrate over geometries. So what we want to do is the path integral over fuzzy space. The way I'm doing that is Markov chain Monte Carlo simulations, because that is what I've learned doing CDT and causal sets. So I figured I can do that with these things as well. I can just do a path integral over the Dirac operators. It's actually relatively easy because these are matrices. They're fairly well behaved. D is a vector space. So we have the Lebesgue measure on D. A slight problem is that D is actually highly constrained by the conditions. I showed you before how we can parameterize D, and that D needs to fulfill first order condition, commutation, relations with chirality, and real structure, and it needs to be self-adjoint. But we can use the parameterization from before, and instead of integrating over D, we integrate over H and L. And then H and L are just Hermitian or anti-Hermitian matrices, which is something we know how to do. actually, if it was just Hermitian and anti-Hermitian matrices we're interested in, then we could even do a lot of it analytically. I'll show you in a little bit why that doesn't work for what we're doing. Not quite. But so once we've got this, we got the measure. We need an action. So I'll tell you a little bit about how to do the action. And then the tricky bit is we need functions of the geometry that we can measure. And of course, we don't only want functions of the geometry. We want functions of the geometry that are somehow physical, that we can interpret in a way. Because just any old function of the Dirac operator might not be particularly interesting.
Do you have any guiding principle for choosing such measure?
The measure? It's...
I don't know, like some invariance or some symmetry? Or if you change the measure, say we can change, right? So you need some principle.
So, I mean, the part of the measure that is in the action, we've got some guiding principle. Everything else is, I mean, it's a vector space. So the Lebesgue measure is kind of the natural thing to use there. So now for the action, what we decided to do is we take the lowest order action in some sense. We're taking trace d to the 4 and then trace d to the squared with a coupling constant. Why don't we only use trace d to the square? Well, that's where we started, but if you only have trace d to the square, your theory is rather boring. It's kind of a free theory, and it doesn't do very much. Having a coupling constant means interesting things like phase transitions start happening to us. We can also sort of physically motivate it, because these two terms are actually the terms that you get if you do the heat kernel. So if you expand the heat kernel in the lowest order, you kind of find these two terms. But there's constants in front of them. But we have a constant which we could tune to match that. Now, if you have any experience with non-commutative geometry, you're going to wonder now, wait a second, why don't we use the Kohn-Shamsuddin action? Truth be told, that action does not work for Monte Carlo simulations because it's not bound. Well, no, it's bounded from below and above, from above and below. So if you try doing that, your theory never thermalizes. There's just too much space to explore, and none of it is suppressed sufficiently strongly to make your Monte Carlo algorithm not get stuck in there. So that's why the Kohn-Shamsuddin action does not work for what we want to do. And this is a good starting point. We will explore further actions eventually, but all of this, I mean, that paper in 2015 is the first paper on this idea of path integral over random fuzzy spaces. So this field is very much in its infancy. Non-commutative geometry in general is much older, and there are a lot of results in the mathematical literature. But from this perspective of using the spectral triple as a parameterization of geometry, that is relatively new.
So is it clear what the classical solution is when G2 is positive? Is D equals zero?
Yes, if G2 is positive, D would have the classical solution d equals 0 at first, but of course then you need to take into account the repulsion between the eigenvalues, and that is where things start getting tricky, because you have the normal repulsion between the eigenvalues of h and l, but then to predict anything about d is very difficult, because eigenvalues of d depend not only on the eigenvalues of h and l, but also on kind of the relative position of the matrices. So we can't do much analytically there. But yeah, if it wasn't for the measure on the space on matrices, then d equals all eigenvalues 0 would be the positive G2 solution. And for negative G2, you'd find 2 minima, and all eigenvalues would be in there. But unfortunately, it's not that easy. Well, fortunately, if it was that easy, we wouldn't be interested in it. So now how do we calculate the action? And I'll talk about that on this simple example. So for the 2-0 geometry, we've got two anticommutators with the matrices H1 and H2. And H1 and H2 are n by n matrices. But our Dirac operator has the left acting part and the right acting part. That is why we have the anticommutator, right? It's first left acting and then it's right acting for each H1 and H2. But if we want to put it on the computer, the easiest way we found is to just go ahead and make it larger. So turn the Dirac operator into a 2n squared by 2n squared matrix, where we have the left acting and the right acting part in the matrix. So this is how we end up doing that. And yeah, there might be more clever ways. If you have one, tell me about it. I'd be very happy to hear. But this was where we started out. And so after we've done this, we can calculate the powers of the Dirac operator just by multiplying these large matrices. And the powers of the anticommutators happen like this. And then we can take the trace and get trace H squared and trace of H squared. And now for those of you that have seen matrix models, trace H squared is a term you know and love in matrix models and know what to do with. But trace H to the square, that is annoying because it leads to non-standard coupling between the eigenvalues. And that is is harder to deal with. Now, if we're using this, we can then calculate the action. We can calculate the d square and the trace d4 term. And they're not actually that nice if we write them down. I mean, we've got trace of h1 and trace of h13 and trace h2 squared h1 multiplied by the other trace. So these are ugly terms. These are terms that analytically you won't get very far with if you want to treat it as a matrix model. But it's still a matrix model. It's a fourth order matrix model with a hell of a lot of weird terms, and it's got two matrices. But it's a matrix model. Of course, this is a 2-0 case that means two matrices. If we have the 1-3 case, that means eight matrices, and they generate the same type of couplings and weird terms. So I don't think you can get very far on this using analytic methods. But for the computer, it's not a big deal. We can very easily implement it on the computer. And the way we do that is as Markov chain Monte Carlo. And our moves are fairly straightforward. We just pick one of the H's and L's, and then we add a tiny increment to it, either to H, a Hermitian tiny matrix, or to L, an anti-Hermitian tiny matrix. And the way I've implemented that is I'm just picking a random matrix with elements between minus 1 and 1. I tried with both uniformly distributed values for the matrix and with normally distributed values for the matrix, and it doesn't make much of a difference. And then because if I just pick at this random matrix, that means the moves are always the same length. And this means that depending on what my action is, my acceptance rate can get very bad. So I found that it's more efficient if I actually add a little real constant c and adjust this constant so that my acceptance rate is a reasonable number. And then I just do that and go ahead, do moves. There's also from somebody else a code that just adds single entry matrices. So H with just one entry. Well, no, two entries, of course, so it's Hermitian, or L with two entries, so it's anti-Hermitian. And that works equally well. So you can do these moves in different ways. And then you need to update the action. And the very laziest method, which I did at first, is you just recalculate the entire action with H replaced by H plus delta H. That is a bit excessive. You can also just keep track of the traces that you need to change and then add the changes. And this makes it slightly more efficient. But my code is not super efficient. My code is mostly written for readability for myself. So I'm willing to wait a week longer for my results if necessary. But I should get more into optimizing. So then with these moves and all of that, I can write my code. My code for Monte Carlo simulations at the moment is written in C++. I'm using the Eigen library for all the matrix algebra, eigenvalue decomposition, and such things. And for analysis, currently, I'm using Python, IPython notebooks, because they're nice and pretty and give nice plots, and they're easy to use and reasonably fast. But I mean, whatever you like, use, like, if you're interested in doing this, don't copy me, come up with something smarter. I'd be very happy. So the bigger problem than actually the Monte Carlo simulations is observables on the space.
Using Monte Carlo methods to do matrix models, is that a tested thing?
Yes, it's been done for other matrix models. There's a bunch of results. On the top of my head, I can think of something by O'Connor, and I forget who else, but there is a bunch of results on...
They can reproduce the exactly solvable matrix
models. Yes, so yes, that's... Yeah, that's very... There's a lot of results on matrix models also with the computer, and it's just that as in the spectral triple way, it's not. So now the problem that we have is, and I'm sure that we'll also hear about this again for the CDT and the causal set talks tomorrow, Monte Carlo simulations on a geometry, that is actually not the hardest part. The hard part is the actual physics, finding something that you can measure. Because whatever you want to measure needs to be completely covariant. You can't say, I measure the value of something at this point, because your geometry fluctuates, so this point will not exist. So you need to mark the point somehow, or... So you need to find things that are completely covariant, completely independent of space. They need to still be reasonably efficient to measure, because... And the problem that I found a lot of times is with the non-commutative stuff. I'll give a talk to non-commutative geometrists, and they come up, hey, we have this definition of a metric. You could measure that. And I look at it. Sure, I will find the supremum over the functions on the algebra for this involved thing a few million times just for every coupling. Of course. Give me a few thousand computers and maybe. So a lot of things that are mathematically well-defined will not be that useful because I can't think of a way to implement them to get a lot of results with it. And of course, we also want to connect to physics. So if I just find something random, I mean, if it's interesting, I'll still look at it and it might be mathematically interesting, but I want to do physics. In the end, I'd like to go and say, oh, we've observed this, now I can tell somebody to maybe go look for that in the real world. Also, that last step is still far, far away. I live in hope. So some examples and things that I'm going to tell you about now that we're looking at, and I'll see how far I get on them. Okay, actually, so the phase transitions. So I'll talk a little bit about critical exponents and thermodynamics, a few things that we've seen this morning about finite size scaling. Okay, transition amplitudes between boundary states is actually not something that we've done yet with the non-commutative stuff. Maybe Sumati will talk about it in causal sets tomorrow, or not? Maybe. Okay. And then in non-commutative geometries, what we can do, which is kind of cool, are observables on the spectrum. I mean, we have the spectrum of the Dirac operator that is fairly fundamental, but then what can we look at? Because just looking at the spectrum, I will show you some plots of the spectrum, but on its own, the spectrum doesn't tell you so much. We want to have some tools to help us interpret the spectrum better. Of course, there is more information than just the spectrum in there. The spectrum alone is not enough, so we'll need to figure that out too, but for now, we have mostly done spectral things. So, for thermodynamic observables, we can look at the average action, the variance of the action, and the average trace of the d squared term, and the variance of that. Why am I looking at the trace of the d squared term? Because it's the order parameter. It's a conjugate variable to the coupling constant g2. So I expect that this term will change across the phase transition, and that it'll tell us something interesting. So now, the first thing we can do when we have this is we can look at where is the phase transition. So we can vary the coupling constant g2, and we also varied n, And then we see there's a phase transition at roughly 2.8. My method to determine the phase transition is I look at the peak of the variance for the action and the peak of the variance for the trace D square term. That is fairly standard. And if I do that, I see that there's some slight variance. It's slightly going down as I increase n, but it's actually, when you look at the scale, it's not very much. And now these n, actually, they look kind of tiny. I mean, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. But what you need to keep in mind is that that means that the Dirac operator for 5 is n squared times 2, so that is 100 by 100 matrix. And the n for 100, that's a 200 by 200 matrix. So the matrices themselves end up fairly big. And that is also why I didn't run anything with larger n, because then things start getting slow. That is where me being lazy and not optimizing my code comes in. So I can locate the phase transition, and if I calculate the average, it's roughly minus 2.8. So that's my working hypothesis. Now, what I'd like to know then is what order is the phase transition? I mean, I will admit I did not come into this unprejudiced, because we know it's a complicated matrix model. These matrix models have been solved analytically, and they have higher order phase transitions. So I was very much expecting the phase transition to be of higher order, and that turned out to be. Now, the easiest way to try and determine a phase transition is by frequency histograms. At least it's my favorite way. So what happens is that at a phase transition, at small volumes of the system, you will see two peaks. The question is, what happens if you increase the volume, so if you increase n? If it's a first order transition, it'll grow apart. First order transition, we saw yesterday, that's a jump, that's a discontinuous transition. And that means that at the computer, you're never quite at the critical temperature, but your system will be jumping between the two states. And that means that you get frequencies for two different states. Now, at a second order transition, what happens at small v is it looks like it's jumping between two states, but it's actually not. And if you increase the system size, you'll see that there's something else happening, and it's a single peak. And I can look at that for the action and for the trace d square term. And so for the action, we see it looks like two peaks, and then it's growing more together. It's getting closer. And for the trace d square, it's even nicer. You could guess here that there's two peaks, but then it becomes. So I think this indicates that my guess that it's a higher order phase transition is reasonable. So, the next thing we can look at is scaling with the size. So naively, because in the variance we've got two sums that go over the number of eigenvalues of the Dirac operator, and these two sums we might expect that gives us n to the 4 terms, so we'd expect the variance to go like n to the 4th. And that's actually not true. What happens is that the terms that go into the variance are these covariance of the eigenvalues squared. And these covariances are something that I found to be quite interesting as observables, because they tell us the correlation between the different eigenvalues. And away from the phase transition, the correlations are only along the diagonal. That means eigenvalues are correlated with themselves, but not very much with other eigenvalues around it. So here again, there's some slight correlation to other eigenvalues, but mostly it's stuff happening along the diagonal. But at the phase transition, boom, we've got this whole blob of things that are strongly correlated. So we have stronger correlation at the phase transition. And again, stronger correlation, strong correlation is a sign for higher order phase transitions. So kind of made me happy when I plotted those. And so what we see is that away from the phase transition, we get a scaling like n squared that works very well. We presumably also see it again here if my simulations had run further down here. So this n squared is, we've got two sums, n squared and n squared, but they only have contributions when the terms in the sums are equal. So actually, it's only one sum. And that's why we have the n squared, and this happens. I can also make a scaling ansatz and do some finite size scaling, as we saw this morning. And I got a scaling exponent, so I can look at the peak of the trace d squared and the of the variance of the trace d squared and the variance of the action. And so we've got a correlation here, but I don't know. I've done this. I'm not so sure what it's. I need to look more into this for the correlation length. I need to explore further what it means, where this correlation comes. Like, maybe I can define a correlation length somehow. But and we can look at critical exponents. The hope was that I find the critical exponents, and they tell me maybe something about the universality class. But it turned out it's not that easy, because the values I find are minus 0.609 and minus 0.33. Unfortunately, I can't do anything on this side of it. I didn't get a good exponent there. And now these values don't match anything that I know of. But also, I've got the critical exponents for the action and for the trace d squared term. But as we saw this morning, usually you've got the magnetic susceptibility. You've got, so even if I could determine the exponents better, another question is, how do I match them to exponents in better known system? Which of these is the magnetization? Is trace d squared my magnetization? Is the action my magnet? Well, action is probably not the magnetization, but so that is the thing about thermodynamic observables. And now I've got about 10 minutes left to talk about the spectral observables, which are the things that I'm actually excited about. So if I just look at the spectrum, that's just the eigenvalues of the Dirac operator, and it's got some advantages. The spectrum is relatively easy to interpret. We know what it is. When I'm thinking as a physicist, the spectrum just corresponds to the modes of energies that are allowed to propagate in my fuzzy space. There's very efficient algorithms ready-made for you to calculate eigenvalues of matrices. That's convenient. And actually, there's a lot of spectrum information in the spectrum. The disadvantage is, well, you can't hear the shape of a drum. So the spectrum is certainly not everything about to know about the geometry. So we need to find other things. We need more observables than just the spectrum. But the spectrum is a good start. You can't hear the shape of a drum, but you can constrain the shape of a drum. So we'll take that. And, well, the other disadvantage is the spectrum of the Dirac operator does not, well, it depends on H and L, but on more than just their eigenvalues. So it would be nice if we could just calculate the eigenvalues of H and L. That's n by n matrices. That's fast. And then get the eigenvalues of the Dirac operator. But of course, that's not the case. So we need more information. We need some kind of CKM matrix between the two. So what we need to do for the eigenvalues is that's size of the Clifford module times n squared dimensional matrices. So that is usually the bottleneck in my simulations, that these matrices take a long time to diagonalize. Now, this is just the spectrum for a 1-3 geometry at n equal 8 and before the phase transition. And you can see each of these is the distribution for a single eigenvalue. There's more eigenvalues in total, but if I plot them all, then it's a mess of lines. So instead, I just picked a few, and we can see each eigenvalue is nicely peaked around a central value, and everything behaves very nicely for this one. No, this is the spectrum for
sample.
Yes, so this is the density in some.
Is there any difficulty, or if you just see a single sample, is it similar or completely different?
No, a single sample would look like a single. For a single geometry, the eigenvalues would be similarly spaced. So.
You order the eigenvalues just by increasing value.
Yes, I have to order them.
If you have a lot of these eigenvalues, then of course the spread can't be larger than, well, the distance between the
Yeah,
eigenvalues.
But we actually, I mean, we've plotted them against each other, and we see that they barely ever touch. So they they don't, like, it doesn't look like they are crossing a lot. Like, so, yes, of course, the ordering does add something there, but.
Well, it could, of course, be that the whole family of eigenvalues shifts from left to right, and then you would see wider pits.
Exactly, like so. Okay. This is a geometry at the phase transition, and here you can see that, as Timothy said, they're still ordered by size, but you see that the eigenvalues closest to zero are getting a lot wider spread. So they're, and also further away from zero, they still, they get this spread. So there's some kind of collective mode happening. And then after the phase transition, they are pressed sufficiently apart. And now the ones close to zero have more of a spread. This is because the potential there is shallow. But further away, they are again. So these are the single eigenvalues. Now, what is easier to interpret in the single eigenvalues is the density of eigenvalues, the density of states, so to say. And for the density of states, we know that it should go like the value of the eigenvalue to d minus 1. And this is the fuzzy sphere, just as an example, where you can nicely see it goes linearly. So that's for two-dimensional geometry. And here is for random geometries of type 1-1 as we cross the phase transition. And you can see how it goes from the red line that is peaked in the middle, and then it's going apart. But this tells you there's probably a phase transition, but it's not the easiest to digest the information this way. So we try to come up with something better to better get out this dimension. And there are, of course, tools meant for that, one of which is the spectral dimension. It has been explored in a lot of approaches, which is why it's a natural starting point for us. And you can define the spectral dimension with this sum. Now, the problem when we're doing this is that we have a Dirac operator, not a Laplace operator. In a Laplace operator, the lowest energy mode is always zero, because you can always have the constant function, which is an eigenfunction with eigenvalue zero. You don't have that for the Dirac operator, which leads to this linear rise over here, which is a domination by the lowest eigenvalue that just happens, and that is not that interesting for us. So we thought about what can we do to get rid of this linear rising mode, and we came up with what we like to call the spectral variance. So we basically just subtract the linear mode. And if we're doing that, we get the black curve. Here, this is the example for an exact sphere. And the black curve does exactly what we expect for a spectral dimension, or for the spectral variance. It starts at 2. It's an exact sphere. It's two-dimensional on short scales. And then it goes down at long scales. It goes down at large scales because the sphere is compact. If you have a spectral dimension and your diffusion time gets long enough, then every sphere will look like a point. If you're running around it often enough, you've basically seen everything and it's just a point. You're zoomed far enough out. So we can try that with our random geometries, and we find that, so the spectral dimension does this rise. These will also rise. They're just rising much later because the lowest mode is much lower before the phase transition. And these are the spectral variances. They show a nice peak. Now, I'm not going to explain this more because I want to get to the other stuff, and I've got about 5 minutes left to talk, if I want to give you time for questions. So the next idea is, so the spectral dimension is a logarithmic derivative of the heat kernel. There's something the heat kernel is related to, which mathematicians really love, and that's the zeta function. So we can use a spectral zeta function. And the cool thing with the spectral zeta function is that it actually contains a lot of information about the geometry. For infinite non-commutative spaces and also infinite commutative spaces, the zeta function has a pole at half the dimension. So by the location of the pole, you can determine the dimension. And by the residue at the pole, you can determine the volume of the geometry. Now, we've got finite geometries, so we don't have a divergence. We don't have the pole. We don't really have the residue. But we can use another estimator for the dimension. Say we use the maximum of the spectral variance as the estimator of the dimension. And then we can look at the value at the value of the zeta function where the dimension is. And then we can use that to estimate the volume by dividing with the logarithm of n, which is at the pole, the eigenvalues should diverge like the logarithm of n. We can show that. So at the pole, the zeta function diverges as the logarithm of n. Sorry. So we can use that to make a volume estimator. And maybe in the future, we can look at other poles, because higher poles of the zeta function contain more curvature invariance. But that gets tricky to get out, because normally you have to subtract the first pole to get to the next pole. But we already have a lot of uncertainty in how we determine the first pole, so how do we get the next pole? And so we can calculate the volume, and it does fairly nice things. And the last bit that I want to talk about is a spectral distance measure between geometries. So this is based on results by Cornelissen and Contreras. So they showed that this is a distance measure that you can use on geometries. And we basically just have to plug our random fuzzy spaces in there to get results. So what this distance measure does, it takes the supremum over S of some in some region of the absolute value of the logarithm of the absolute value of the ratio of the zeta functions. So I take two geometries, x1 and x2. I calculate the zeta functions as a function of S. I divide the zeta functions by each other. I take the absolute value. I take the logarithm. I take the absolute value. And then I look over a range of S between gamma and gamma 1 and scan for the supremum of this function. Now, gamma has to be larger than d over 2, so it needs to lie above the pole. But other than that, gamma should the result should be mostly gamma independent. And we see that that's actually true. The motivation for this is that the zeta function automatically suppresses high eigenvalues. In the zeta function, you've got eigenvalue to the minus s, absolute value of the eigenvalue, or square of the eigenvalue for us, so that it's positive. But so it's eigenvalue to the minus s. So large eigenvalues get suppressed by this minus s factor. So the zeta function, comparing the zeta function means we compare the spectra up to a certain point. So we sort of compare spectra where we say what's at the very largest eigenvalues we don't care so much about. And the first thing to test this distance measure for us, I mean, in the paper, they use the distance measure for non-commutative cases with infinite spectra. So we wanted to test, does it work with finite spectra? So we test the fuzzy sphere against the exact sphere. And we see it happens what we want. We've got a fuzzy sphere with n by n matrices. The distance to the exact sphere is larger for a fuzzy sphere with 100 by 100 matrices. We also see it's going very slow that it gets smaller, so, but that is not exactly unexpected. Sorry, I don't know what happened there. So the next test for the distance measure is something we did with our random geometries, and that is just I picked, this is the two zero geometries, and I picked the geometry at minus 2.8, so at the phase transition, as a comparison geometry, and compared it to the geometries at other coupling constants. And what we see happening is that the distance is large. As we get closer to it, it gets smaller. It's zero for that, and then it goes away again. So this is all consistent, and we're going to use it to compare our random geometries to the fuzzy sphere and to each other. But that is not quite done, and I figured I wouldn't have much time, so I didn't include that in the slides. So I've talked a lot now, but what do I hope that you've heard a bit about, learned a bit about now is non-commutative geometries, particularly fuzzy spaces. And that's the hard part in what we're trying to do is finding good observables. Observables here in the sense of things that we can calculate and compare to something we have an intuition about. and that can tell us something about the geometries we're looking at. So, thanks.
Are your geometries more like large and flat, or more like small and crumpled up, or you don't know?
So that is what we're trying to understand right now. It looks as if the geometries at the phase transition have some similarities to the fuzzy sphere. I mean, the geometries, I should have made that maybe clearer in the introduction, in non-commutative geometries, the geometries we have, they're always compact geometries. So they will always be somewhat smallish and crumplish. But yeah, we don't have very good measures yet to look at that.
Could you embed them?
Possibly. There's some results by Harald Steinacker in which he does the embedding, but he uses a weird definition as the Dirac operator that doesn't actually fulfill the first order condition. So there's some, but he and his student made a Mathematica worksheet on these things.
Related, or maybe essentially the same question. If a matrix is given, any matrix corresponds to some geometry or some smooth geometry, it's not regular.
Well,
if you just pick up random matrix where it does not really have any classical picture.
So any matrix that any set of Hermitian or anti-Hermitian matrices H and L will give me a fuzzy space. But if that fuzzy space corresponds to anything that is like a continuum geometry, it's rather unlikely. I mean,
so you need some very nice thing like fuzzy sphere.
Yeah, so we're hoping that at the phase transition, the state will have similarities to nice things and that we compare them to. But the most general fuzzy spaces are not necessarily related to anything geometric.
Do you think that, you're measuring spectrum or anything that's consistent with such expectations, such nice thing is appearing?
So yes, there's bits that look consistent. So I didn't include that now, but that is why we started with the distance measure, because that lets us somehow qualify if we're getting close to the fuzzy sphere in any sense or not. And with some additional caveats about having to scale the eigenvalues correctly and so on, it looks like it's similar to the fuzzy sphere.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is relevant or useful. Can you go back to the statistics of eigenvalues of the Dirac operator?
You mean this?
Yes. So, from what I understood, trace of d square plus the quadratic term, the quartic term, is the action.
Yes.
So, in trace of d square is like the free Hamiltonian.
Mm-hmm.
In some sense. Now, it looks like you have a transition from two level statistics. Now, the one thing that usually label spacing can detect this transition from chaotic to integrable models. And
mm-hmm.
if you plot the probability of having a certain level spacing, you can see that probably this is going to look like a Poissonian distribution and the other one is going to look like the Wigner surmise. And then
okay.
you can, but you have to use the eigenvalues of d square, not of d.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't know if this can be useful.
I haven't looked at it, but it sounds interesting. So
this is the standard way to detect integrable models from chaotic models in condensed matter.
Okay.
You look at the level spacing statistics, and if it's a Wigner distribution, it's chaotic. If it's a Poissonian distribution, it's integrable. And indeed, you have the most important feature is that you have level repulsion.
Okay.
Which is something that you have in.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean,
no, that sounds very interesting.
Useful.
I'll
yes.
have a look at it, definitely.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Any more questions? Are everyone ready for the poster session?
Or maybe just one comment. So your title was random and fuzzy.
Yeah.
But the non-random and fuzzy is also a very useful thing, especially in string theory context. And as far as I know, if you try to regularize supersymmetric Hermites, which is relevant for ADS-GFT correspondence, but it's the only way. And for example, some specific fuzzy sphere configuration matrix model is believed to describe M theory or type 2 string theory. So,
distribution
also would be interesting. It's a different topic, but the fuzzy sphere is very useful when, even when it's not random.
Yes, thank you.